Fresh Air are Malachy and Frank McCourt, the performers and co-authors of the play A Couple of Blackguards. It's a two-person review that features Irish stories, jokes, and songs. The McCourts are brothers, and they both grew up in Limerick, Ireland, and later moved to the United States. Malachy McCourt supported himself at various times as a bartender, dock worker, and gold smuggler until he began getting work as an actor. He appeared in the Broadway show Mass Appeal, as well as in the movies The Dane Curse, You Can't Go Home Again, The Molly Maguires, The Brinks Job, and Q, The Serpent. He also was in the soap operas Ryan's Hope, where he played a bartender, and Search for Tomorrow. He hosted a TV show on Channel 9 in New York and a radio show on WMCA. Frank McCourt also spent time as a New York dock worker, but went on to an academic career that took him back to Ireland, to Trinity College in Dublin. He now teaches English at Stuyvesant High School in New York. Malachy and Frank McCourt will be performing A Couple of Blackguards this Saturday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and 8 in the evening at the Society Hill Playhouse at 507 South 8th Street. For more information, you can call 923-0210. That's 923-0210. They previously performed this at the top of the gate at the Village Gate in New York. I want to welcome you both to Fresh Air. May I ask you to open with a performance excerpt from your show?
We'll do that, Terry. You, McCourt, who made the world?
A God.
God what?
A God, sir.
Who is God?
God is the creator and sovereign lord of heaven and earth and of all things,
and
sir.
Why did God make the world?
God made the world so we'd all have something to stand on, sir.
Oh, there's something very strange about a boy who gives an answer like that, isn't there, boys? I'll hop off you,
sir,
McCourt.
Sir.
It spoke.
Sir, I know the seven deadly sins.
Oh, the boy doesn't know why God made the world, but the boy knows the seven deadly sins. Well, we'll see what the boy knows. Tell us the first deadly sin.
Pride.
Pride what?
Pride, sir.
Pride. The minute I spot the pride, out comes the stick and there will be a smiting. What will there be, boys?
A smiting, sir.
The next deadly sin.
The greed, sir.
Ah, yes, McCourt, you have a head bulging with the greed. There's a head that will wind up with the hangman's knot under the chin, the tongue dangling, the eyes popping from their sockets. And now, my fine expert, tell us the third deadly sin.
The lust, sir.
Ah, the lust. But we won't dawdle over that one, will we, boys?
We won't, sir.
You can always spot the ones that are at the lust, at himself and interfering with himself. What is he, boys?
At himself, sir.
And?
Interfering with himself, sir.
And then he gets the pimples all over his face, a half acre of pimples. And when I see a boy with the pimples, I'll know. What will I know, boys?
You know he has the pimples, sir.
No, you blithering idiots, I'll know he's been at himself. And then the warts. Warts, boys, squatting on the skin like dead lice. The warts and pimples so thick you can hardly tell whose face it is, but we won't talk about that, too. No, for that way madness lies, as Shakespeare said. Madness, half of the people above in the lunatic asylum are there because of the lust. And I know you, McCourt. You're a prime candidate for the lust department of the lunatic asylum. And the next time I catch...
But, sir...
What?
Sir...
It spoke again.
I know the best deadly sin, sir.
The best deadly sin?
Yes, sir. The best deadly sin, sir, is the sloth. Because sloth is doing nothing. And if you're doing nothing, you can't be committing the other deadly sin, sir. So sloth is the best deadly sin.
Oh, a theologian. Enough on the deadly sins. McCourt, if you lead a good and virtuous life, which in your case is doubtful, what is the reward?
The reward for leading a good and virtuous life is that you're admitted to heaven, to stand before the throne of God for eternity, to gaze on his divine countenance in awe, wonder, and reverence, sir.
That's right.
But, sir, is that all?
Is what all?
Is that all you'll get for leading a good and virtuous life, to be admitted to heaven, to stand gazing on God's face for eternity? I mean, wouldn't you get weary standing there?
Oh, you pagan. Looking on God's countenance is good enough for this one. Is it dancing girls you want? Is it brass bands, parades, circuses? Out with your hand. Before I'm done with you, I will teach you to love the gentle Jesus.
Ah!
That was great. Thanks for performing that. That was Malachy and Frank McCourt, who will be performing their show, A Couple of Blackguards, this Saturday at 3 and 8 o'clock at the Society Hill Playhouse. How'd you start doing this show together? Frank, you're not even a professional actor.
I
mean,
no.
You're a teacher and scholar.
A teacher is a professional actor. He's the most professional of all actors because he's putting on five shows a day.
Any teacher will tell you that's so. But Malachy and I have often dined out on some of the stories we told them, and we would amuse people. So we decided to get together. And we didn't actually write a script in the beginning. We did it. We inveigled our way into a place called the Billy Monk Theatre, and we made a list of stories. And with great gall, we went on the stage, and we used to change the list every night because we found out it worked a different way. So that's how it started. We ran for 7 weeks at the Billy Monk, no sign of a script.
And it wasn't for a long time that we ever... We sometimes would say, what am I... We'd be whispering to each other on the stage. You say, I say, you say, I say.
What's next?
What's next? And then the panic. And we got through it all right. And it was very simply the old tradition of Irish storytelling and making, with this, although the stories are true, they're not, we elaborate on them without exaggeration. But they're all essentially autobiographical.
You understand that now, don't you? To elaborate without exaggeration. That's.
I was just trying to coin a very clever phrase, Frank. I think these things up before I go on radio shows.
I know.
You both grew up in Ireland.
We were dragged up in Limerick.
Yeah.
What kind of family?
There were, as usual, of course, most everybody has a father and mother, whether you know them or not. We knew our mother quite well, and we were slightly acquainted with our father because he got the Irish divorce.
What's the Irish divorce, Malachy?
He disappeared into England when we were quite young. Frank was 9 and I was 8. I want to get that across, that Frank is older than I am. There were 7 of us, and if you're pessimistic, you would say that 3 died. If you're optimistic, you'd say that 4 lived, which was about the... it was about the average. I think it was about 40% infant mortality where we grew up, because it was a slum. Huge sanitary and health problems and all. It was just dreadful. But at the same time, death did break up the monotony of our daily lives, because people trotted out the food and the drink, port and sherry and porter, and buns and biscuits and currant cakes and the singing.
Well, we don't worry about AIDS too much. We develop great immunity to everything.
If you got beyond your first communion, you were very hardy. You had a good chance. It was really Darwinian in the sense that the survival of the fittest. But sometimes it. There were diseases there that were only known, I think, in Calcutta and Bombay.
Yeah, I got one of them.
You got typhoid.
Did you really?
When I was 11,
And you survived it?
Oh, sure, yeah. I was in the hospital for 3.5 months. I nearly died. The doctor came to my house to... it was around the time of my confirmation. Things always happen to me around the time of religious occurrences. Anyway, the doctor came and told my mother that I had a cold. It was no regular doctor. A regular doctor was on vacation. This other man was an alcoholic. So I could smell the whiskey off his breath. And he said, keep him in bed.
It nearly cured you, Frank.
He has a cold. So then I started bleeding from every orifice in my body.
And including the hole in his head.
Yeah. The regular doctor came back and just picked me up and took me to the hospital. So typhoid, they didn't have... the refined facilities they have now. It took me 3.5 months.
In the fever hospital.
In the fever hospital. And then when we were going home from the hospital, the doctor said to my mother, give him plenty of red meat, which amused my mother and me, because there was no such thing. I mean, we couldn't afford it. The nearest thing we got was beef tea, you know, one of those cubes, you drop a cube. That was the nearest
Oxo.
So I survived that.
Did it change your perspective on the world to have a brush with death at age 11?
I don't know. I think you're living like that. Nothing was extraordinary, because people were dying all the time. I don't know if it was just our age. We were always going to funerals and wakes.
There were 11 of our classmates died.
We belonged to the Death of the Month Club. We were constantly being dragged off to funerals and wakes, and they were very enjoyable.
There was one fellow was dying, one of our classmates was dying, and Paddy O'Brien, and he had what they call the galloping consumption. And it was toward the end of August, And you see, when the kids died, it was about 11, and we used to get a half day off to go to the funeral. So we always hoped they would die during the school year. So Paddy was dying anyway, and Frank went up there, and he threatened him that if he died during the holidays, he'd kill him. So Paddy lingered on till we went back to school, so we got the half day off. Frank was very cruel that way.
How old were you when you moved to America?
19.
Did you initiate it, or was it your mother?
No, Frank saved up his own money.
I came over by myself.
And you came over afterwards?
He sent for me. He couldn't stand the loneliness.
Yeah, desperately lonely, so I sent for him. But I wasn't here when I came, because I was in the army then in Germany. So he had to fend for himself.
Which is all right.
I fended for myself, and he fended for my people. And then when I came back from the army, we rarely. It's only until we started doing the show that we ever saw much of each other, because he lived in we lived in different parts of New York. He lived in Manhattan, and I lived in Brooklyn. And we had different approaches to life. He was disorderly and chaotic, and I'm respectable.
Yeah. And very dull.
A taxpayer.
Extremely dull. Yeah, one of those assimilated types he was.
Well, when I came here, I had a variety of menial jobs, and I said, this isn't for me. I used to work down in the piers and in the warehouses and hotels and so on. I felt I was too good for it. Even though I came from a slum, I felt I was too good for this stuff. So I was in the village one day, and there was New York University. And I went in and applied. I didn't have any credentials. I never went to high school or anything like that, but I talked my way in.
I didn't know you could do that to a university.
I did. But it's in the show. This segment is in the second act of the show. It's how I got into New York University. It was but I was determined that I was going to go to college.
Well, one of the things that one of the advantages, our television, our radio, our entertainment was reading. That took us away. That gave us the inspiration to get out of the slum. And there were two ways out of the lane where we lived in. One was in the coffin, and the other was on your two feet and off to America. That was the dreamland. If your dreams were slightly less, you could always go to England. But we're both avaricious or omnivorous readers for some reason. And consequently, we have been able to get away with an awful lot over the years that people assume that we went to school. Like, Frank must be the only high school teacher in America that doesn't have a high school diploma.
Well, and
or one of the few anyway.
Up in charges.
Yeah, for flaunting it.
Or fraud.
Or flouting it. But we, in that sense, then we had no formal education. Frank left when he was 13, and so did I. We went to work as messenger boys and that sort of thing. But there's nothing like that sort of thing to give you the impetus to get out of sticking with that menial type of thing, or the idea of pensionable jobs and security and all of that. We just couldn't be bothered with that.
But you just started as a dock worker, didn't you?
Oh, sure, but...
How'd you get from that into acting?
I walked into a theatre one night. I used to always... After I came to America, I loved going to theatre one way or another, so I used to go. And one night I went backstage at an off-Broadway theatre, and I spoke to a producer, and he said... I said, I would like to join your group. That's how I thought you became an actor. And he said, what experience do you have? And I said, oh, I wouldn't need any for what you're doing up there. Well, he thought he was getting sent up or put on or whatever it is they say. So he said, do you have any pictures? And I said, I had a passport picture. I didn't know about 8x10 glossies. So then he had me read, as he put it. And again, we use this in the show as well. It I thought it was a literacy test. So I came back the next Sunday to read for them, and the producer, the director, and somebody else. And they said, that's absolutely marvelous. So they hired me. And so I got a job as an actor, having never been on the stage in my life. And all the reviews were terrific. In the next show they did, which was the Playboy of the Western World by John Millington Synge. So I got very interested in that, and And then I said, God, this is terrific. So I give up the docks. I give up, it was $100 a week I was making then on the docks, which is a lot of money. And I went to $35 a week as an actor. But I was so happy doing that. It's a miserable bloody life, but it makes me very happy.
When you first both got to America, did you want to live in Irish-American neighborhoods?
Well, when I got here, I suddenly, we've often discussed this, you're thrown into an entirely different culture. You saw the movies. We grew up going to movies and dreaming of it. And James Cagney, we wanted to be gangsters and
convicts.
Or cowboys or convicts, anything. John Wayne, James Cagney.
You know, it's so Calvary, as they say.
or we wanted to join the fight in 69. So when I got here anyway, I suddenly became aware of being Irish. Because people would say, oh, is that a brogue? I didn't know what a brogue was first of all, so I
saw that was a pair of shoes.
And I tried for a while. I made a vain attempt to try to assume or affect an American accent, and it didn't work. Because even in the jobs that I had, everybody, including the Irish Americans, would comment. They'd imitate me, and I at that time I thought they all came up with their version of Barry Fitzgerald. Ah, how are you this morning, Frank? And ah, it's a lovely day. And sure they'd say, "Faith and begotten." You're going to go out and have some whiskey and so on. And I'd have to put up with this, and I was in a rage most of the time. But then I became aware of this Irishness, this ethnic stuff that we thought nothing of it when we were growing up in Ireland. And I had a radio, and I discovered there were Irish radio programs, and they were playing Irish music. And of course, I was a bit lonely, so I used to listen to this stuff. So, in New York, I was sitting in New York, being more Irish in New York than I ever was in Ireland. And one thing led to another till I started reading Irish literature, which I knew nothing about before, because whatever literature we had when we were in Ireland was English. We had Wordsworth and Gray, Elegy in a Country Churchyard, all of that stuff.
And although Irish literature was banned in Ireland.
Was it really?
Yeah. Oh, Joyce and Behan, the whole bloody lot of them. O'Casey's plays were banned in the Abbey Theatre, and some of Yeats's poems were not allowed to be published. It was almost axiomatic that if it were a good piece of Irish literature, it were banned in Ireland. And they had a film censorship board there as well, so they cut a lot of the films. And one censor, who made a very clever remark when he was asked why there was a film censorship board, and he said, to prevent the Californication of Ireland.
Did you go through the same thing, Malachi, when you came to New York, of suddenly being aware of being Irish?
I didn't know I was Irish till I came here. I thought the whole world was exactly the same as myself. But I found a certain, heaviness about the Irish Americans, in that they were neither, they had a sort of fake idea of what Ireland was, what Ireland is, and it was also to do with thatched roofs and whitewashed cottages and romantic and little Irish mothers with white hair handing out cups of buttermilk at the door and people, little fairies, and the quiet man sort of thing.
And Barry Fitzgerald.
And then brawling and fighting and drinking and then going home and falling into bed. And I found they were lacking in the bit of poetry. The language was very sparse. They didn't use it to any great extent. But then I realized the exigencies of life here are quite different. It's faster paced, the pressures are greater, and indeed hyphenated people are not native people. The hyphen becomes a minus sign, in a sense. It takes away the best of both, I think, in some sort of a way. And it's always very sad for me to see people trying to be what they are not. So I made a conscious effort to stay away from getting involved in the almost parochial, and even the provincial attitudes of the Irish. So I moved into another area completely. So in no time, with all of my madness and the what I think back at now, tremendous energy, was getting out and moving into other areas, into the theatre, and I liked, I didn't mind cavorting on Park Avenue and going to jet set parties and the best nightclubs and all of that sort of thing. And I began to realise people saying, isn't he a wonderful character? And I said, yeah, I'm a wonderful character. I'll play the game. And I did I played it to the hilt. And I did everything they expected of me. I was wild and I drank far too much than was good for me. And I learned, I didn't know many songs, but I learned songs. Like I sing at parties.
Which are the songs you were supposed to learn to play the role right?
What songs?
Yeah.
Oh, I would learn some filthy parodies of Irish songs, which I can't do on this family radio here. Or any song, for that matter, stuff with choruses, Carrick Fergus, or even quote a bit of poetry for them. I would do everything that was expected, and it worked out quite well.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Malachy and Frank McCourt. They're brothers, and they'll be performing this weekend. It's a performance that they've done in New York at several venues, including the Top of the Gate at the Village Gate. This Saturday's performances are at 3 and 8 at the Society Hill Playhouse. Their show is called A Couple of Blackguards, and it's a lot of stories and songs, a lot of autobiography in it as well. You said that you were playing up the Irish thing to the hilt at parties and stuff. Well, what about as an actor? Did you have to, like, you know, tone up the brogue or maybe tune it down sometimes depending on what was
I tried to get rid of the adjective Irish on actor because in the last 10 years or so, after I got fired from a controversial radio program that I had for 6 years in New York, I decided to get back to acting and do it quite seriously. So then without actually studying at any academies or anything like that, I decided to have a look at the techniques of television, film, and theater. So I took it quite seriously then. However, I have difficulty with what they call this accent of mine, and so I just speak as I speak, and I just don't want to be considered. I just want to be the only adjective I want on actor is splendid, and it suits me just fine that if people don't use the term Irish actor, because we are generally tossed into roles as bartenders, priests, and policemen. Sometimes they're quite good, but it's. I now feel I should be a cardinal or a police commissioner or the mayor of New York or something like that. That would suit me just fine if they would. But again, people say, well, this doesn't call for an Irishman. See, it's amazing racism about the Irish. Casting people and directors and producers are not supposed to refer, according to our union rules and agreements, not supposed to refer to the race of a person. They can, if a black actor walks in, they can't say, oh, you better go out and turn white and come back in here and apply for the part, or if you're Chinese. Or they're not supposed to refer to the age of a woman, although things are terribly difficult for women in the theatre. If you're over 30 now, it's almost impossible to get a job for women. But they have no compunction about saying, oh, we don't want Irish. No Irish need apply. Still applies.
The Irish don't object.
Yeah, well, I do.
You do.
I bring people up very short on that sort of thing.
As somebody said once in one of Andrew Greeley's books on the Irish in America, what is it called? That most distressful
country.
People or country. Some professor in Midwest wanted to start a course in Irish studies and he wanted to federal grant, so he went to the Department of Education and they wouldn't give it to him. And he said, why? The man said, because the Irish don't count anymore. We've faded in, we've become assimilated. But there's another generation coming up now, discovering the folk music and so on. I don't know what value there is in that, but they want something. They're plugging in somewhere. Well, I'm always concerned with this myself because if you have children, if you teach, you're always wondering what to pass on. What is it? What are we passing on? What is American culture? Is it Emerson and Thoreau, or do we use all the ethnic stuff too? You're constantly, if you have to make up a book list to teach a class, you're wondering what to include in.
How about through the overalls in Mrs.
That's
Murphy's
right.
Child,
well,
Frank?
This great Irish American stuff that all the Irish purists sneer at it all the time. Finnegan's Wake is an Irish American song. Who threw the overalls in Mrs. Murphy's Child? There's a song in that album you have there. My Irish Molly, all, and which has been discovered, the kind of music that sustained the Irish here in the 19th century. But You could spend the rest of your life, I suppose, wrestling with this ethnic stuff. And I think one of the reasons we did this show, one of the reasons I'm writing certain stuff myself, is to purge myself of it. And sometimes I have great desire to wake up in the morning as nothing.
You will, Frank. You will. Don't worry about it, Frank.
I often wonder what George Plimpton feels like when he wakes up.
He feels like nothing.
Nothing.
But I bet as a high school teacher, and you teach at Stuyvesant in New York, that you encounter a lot of teenagers who are just starting to go through like encounters with their own ethnic history and whether they want to immerse themselves in that or not.
Yeah. And there are very, very few kids of Irish ancestry there, but it's probably the best school in the city. It is the best school in the city, maybe the country. So they're very bright, brilliant.
You're a modest man, Frank.
So, no, I didn't make them that way.
Well, you're saying you're teaching at the best school in the country, therefore that makes you the best English teacher in America.
Well, if I could fake my way into NYU, I could fake my way into Stuyvesant.
Have you ever tried faking your way out of there?
So, for instance, there was a Jewish kid asked me, said he wanted to talk to me recently because he's having problems. I don't know why he asked me. He went to Israel and he came back religious. He wants to eat only kosher food, and his mother wouldn't go along with that. So there's warfare. And I said, look, what can you do? You can't win. You're living under your mother's roof. But he's in pain over this. I never went through that kind of pain, but I suppose.
Yes, you did, Frank.
I did, not. Great pain.
Seven deadly sins.
Great anguish.
And you broke all the Ten Commandments coming down.
So you are, the high school kids are going through that stuff.
They are, yeah.
Malky, you've owned bars. And then played the role of a bartender on Ryan's Hope.
And Search for Tomorrow, which I'm doing now, currently.
Well, I know that you said before that one of the only roles really open to the Irish is as a bartender. So did you take that on with mixed feelings?
I didn't. I embraced it because it was a chance. I mean, bartending in real life is totally different from doing it on television. So you learn to interact with other characters. Essentially, most of the time, bartenders don't do anything. Traditionally, when you look at bartenders in film and on television, they do two things. You will see them wiping the same spot on the bar all the time while they're talking thus. My hand is going around and around and around on this table. Or they will pick up a glass in contravention of all the sanitary regulations in most of every city in this country. They will wipe a glass with a filthy towel and then serve you a drink in it. That's what they do in film. And then, of course, there are all sorts of ideas. The bartenders are philosophers, psychologists, and so on. A lot of all rubbish. They're in a certain environment, and they're there to push this drink. So I don't mind it at all. It's very easy, and I don't have doing it on television or on film. I've done it about 10 times, I think, in the films or on commercials and so on.
Did you ever have, like, St. Patrick's Day celebrations in the bars that you own?
Oh, in my own bars?
Yeah.
You can't help it. People just invade you. One year, I put up in a whimsical way, I put a sign up in my door which said, "No Irish need apply." And they kicked down the door. I thought I was going to get killed. I mean, another time I put a sign in the window of one of the bars that said English spoken here, and the Urban League came in. So people were very upset about that. And so I just felt there is, mind you, a lack of appreciation of whimsicality at times.
Did you ever do the whole green beer routine?
Oh, no, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that. That's carrying things. Because anyway, green is not really St. Patrick's color. St. Patrick's blue is the real color, and green is a relatively new sort of a thing.
Frank, you left Ireland when you were 18,
19,
think.
Yeah.
19. And you had been very poor when you lived in Ireland. Now you're a teacher, a performer. You returned to Ireland for postgraduate studies,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I was supposed to get the PhD, but I'm afraid I had too good a time in Dublin. I became interested in the Irish-American stuff, so I was doing research there on Irish-American literature. And I did all the research, but I never finished the dissertation. Too good a time. So I'm teaching high school, and it's lovely.
Well, don't you teach in community college too?
Oh yeah, I teach in community college, and it's not a community college anymore in New York. And I write.
What was it like when you returned to Ireland? Was the country like you remembered it?
Well, I went back to Dublin. I didn't grow up in Dublin. I knew very little about Dublin. So, but and uh, Dublin is a very hard city to live in if you move in certain circles, because if you drink, it's very hard to walk out the door without meeting somebody. And they always said, let's go for a pint. And you go in for a pint and there goes your day. I used to leave my apartment in Dublin in the morning to head for the library at Trinity, and I would say, I am not going into a pub today. And I would take side streets, but then around noon or so, you'd say, oh, I have to have a sandwich. And I'd go out, I'd leave my books on the desk in Trinity and go out, and I wouldn't go back till the next day. And that's what happened to my PhD. I know it's an epic and weakness about it. If you want to get a PhD, stay away from Dublin.
Do you have any regrets about that?
I had a good time. Yeah, I sometimes I regret not having got it, but I where I am now, I'm satisfied with.
Do you both follow politics in Northern Ireland now?
I do. And speaking for myself, and I've gotten very objective about it, as opposed to the passionate subjectivity of a lot of people around. And I find myself very distressed by what goes on there, and the appalling worldwide ignorance of the real facts of the situation, where they make it sectarian. Where they're talking about, isn't it astounding in this day and age that they talk about Catholic gunmen, and it's the Protestant gunmen, and in Beirut they talk about Christian gunmen. What a fierce contradiction! Christian gunmen. I mean, if they're following the footsteps of Christ, they you don't carry guns.
They don't talk about Protestant prostitutes.
That's right.
Catholic prostitutes.
Catholic, you see, so they make the it's in the. Very simply, it's an imposed artificial border on a very tiny country, imposed by force and by British rule. And the people up in the north of Ireland, the people in the north, there's 1.5 million people there, 1 million of one religion and 500,000 of another. And it's tuppence halfpenny looking down on tuppence, because unemployment is rampant, people in the same economic condition. And most of the sources of production there are owned by the Crown and the House of Lords. The British government puts in £500 million a year in there to keep this security force in. But what they're not saying is that private interests are hauling out £2 billion in profits a year out of that place, because people still work, people still function, people still get on with their daily lives, regardless of violence, no matter where you are. Life went on in Vietnam. Life went on in France during the Second World War. Life even went on in Germany when it was decimated, and England. So people are still producing, and those profits are going into the Crown and the House of Lords. They have found now enormous quantities of oil and gas off the coast of Ireland. There are many, many wells that they're keeping capped. Now, that's one reason why the British are staying there, because they want to hold on to these future reservoirs of oil and gas. And they're not going to stir out until there's some sort of one of these days there's going to be another oil shortage. Then off comes the caps, and it'll be like the North Sea. The British will have them there, and they'll be able to sell all this oil that off the coast of Ireland.
Did you find that most of the Irish-American community sides with Northern Ireland?
They have a romantic view of what it is. They have a romantic view of the IRA and the old stuff about the boys dying for their country. So they know very little about it. How could they know anything about it? You don't get any news in American newspapers. You'd have to get Irish newspapers, and some of the Irish American newspapers give you some detail. But there's no, unless you're a reader, unless you go to the library and get the books and so on. Otherwise, there's no way of knowing. They like to think of the boys on the run with the gun, and that's enough.
Singing.
And then you get emotional on St. Patrick's Day, and you want to go over them. Even in my daily life, my students would say, "Oh, they assume that I hate the English." And how can I? I say, "How can you hate a country that produces Shakespeare?" And they want me to hate the English, and they want you to fit into the stereotype. And it's easy to fit into the stereotype. They're all, Mr. McCord, you're going to be in on St. Patrick's Day, and they're surprised when I show up. And then they look at me the next day to see if I'm falling down with a hangover. They want me to fall down with a hangover, and they bring me green bagels. I hate bagels, and I despise green bagels. I don't want the green bagel. Actually, they were bringing me green cream cheese and green salmon. This is what they want. And it's comforting in a way when you're Irish or when you're an observer of the Irish to fall into the stereotype or to expect the stereotype. They like me to sing. I sing Irish songs with my students. I like the songs, and they love them. But they're disappointed if I depart from their preconceptions of the Irishman. They want me to rant against the English, which I'm not about to do any more than I'm going to make speeches in favour of the Irish. Because, you, as Malachy said, you become objective after a while. You're 3,000 miles away and years and years, generations away, decades away anyway.
And you have your own life in America, and we have children grow up here. And I try not to... instill any sort of prejudice or bigotry in my own children, because it's very, very damaging. So you say to your children, you have to hate the English. Well, why should we perpetuate that sort of awful thing? English people are very decent people. I mean, their governments are bloody stupid. There's no doubt about that.
Well, governments are not.
For 800 years they've been stupid. And they keep on making the same damn mistakes over and over again. And whatever the British government has been, they leave a history of bloodshed. They left it here. They left it in Palestine, Israel. They left it in India. Civil wars everywhere you go. Same thing in China and all the Arab countries. They have. They leave people to say. They say, well, you say, you can't have those people governing themselves. There will be a bloodbath. Well, they ensure there's going to be a bloodbath by inciting people with one thing or another.
Well, we're about out of time. And I was wondering, Frank, since you've been performing, has your teaching changed?
No, I don't know. No. I think I discovered early on the value of entertaining a class. So I don't think the teaching has changed. I've learned things from acting about compressing things and so on, but I don't know. I'll figure that out one of these days.
Do you think you'll be writing more shows?
Well, Frank and myself, maybe not together. I think this was, we nearly tore each other apart on this one, on disagreements, but we're rather fond of each other, and as a matter of fact, we love each other. But we are separately doing things. Frank is going to do a novel, and I'm at a play, which I hope to get finished very soon. I'm a terrible procrastinator. And I don't type, but I just crack myself up with my wit and humor and all of that. And I'm very modest.
Sometimes
well.
He doesn't go out for days.
Yeah, I'm laughing so much at what I write.
Cracking himself up
and
with
And can
his
we
wit.
Say that the, what did our producer tell us, that the policemen and firemen of Philadelphia can come in for half price?
Oh, yeah,
to
the
on
show.
On Saturday?
This is the show in Philadelphia.
The show in Philadelphia. Not into the radio station.
No.
Coming here for nothing.
Stay away from the radio station. Half price for the uniform here as a Philadelphia.
Is that what he said?
Yeah.
Okay, well, listen, thanks so much for being with us, and thanks for the performance excerpt that you did earlier.
Thank you,
Terry.
It's really been fun.
It was a grand pleasure to be with you.
I've been speaking with Malachy and Frank McCourt. They're the performers and co-authors of A Couple of Blackguards. It's a two-person review that they'll be doing this Saturday at the Society Hill Playhouse at 507 South 8th Street. For more information, you can call 923-0210. That's 923-0210. Frank McCourt teaches at Stuyvesant High School and is currently working on a novel. Malachy McCourt is an actor who's been in the Broadway show Mass Appeal, in the soap operas Ryan's Hope and Search for Tomorrow, and in several films, including Cue the Serpent and the Molly Maguires. The show, again, is this Saturday at 3 and 8 o'clock at the Society Hill Playhouse, and they're based in New York. 16 minutes to 4 is the time. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY FM in Philadelphia. At 4...